So yesterday, this title slide had the title Myths of Marriage and That Heart Was Broken. And then I showed the slides to Liv, and she said, everyone is going to think that our marriage is going terribly if you use that as your title slide. So I changed it, and now we are on to something else. Either way, we're talking about the same topic, which is going to be a passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I didn't practice this, so okay, great. It all works. Incidentally, I wrote this sermon before Liv and I even started dating, but we talked about this subject afterward, and we both thought that this was important and also something that might be befitting of this particular day in our secular culture as well. So, if you will, turn your attention with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and we're going to read verses 8 or I wrote verses 9 and 8, should be 8 and 9. 1 Corinthians 7, 8 and 9. There the apostle says, but I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain unmarried, even as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. There was an event that inspired me to start thinking about this passage a little bit differently than I had when I was growing up, and this sermon was a result of experiencing that event. And that was reading a Facebook post from a young brother in the church, and now this was a couple of years ago, but I've heard similar things since then. And in this Facebook post, he wrote a long essay about his frustration with being basically rejected by women in the church when he asked them on dates. The main point of that post was for him to complain that sisters in the church were maybe too selective about who they wanted to date. He saw the selectiveness of our sisters as being borderline sinful, if not outright sinful, because he had feelings and desires that he knew could not be satisfied without marriage. And so he basically felt like it was our sister's fault that he sinned and lusted because they rejected his advancements, and the only recourse he thought he had to those temptations was to get married. In his Facebook post, this brother cited 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 9 to basically argue that marriage, in his opinion, is the cure to the problem of lust. And if marriage is the cure, he said, that means women in the church need to reciprocate romantic attention from virtually any man who shows them affection in order to keep that man from sinning. Now, although most people who publicly cite 1 Corinthians 7 and 9 in the pulpit don't usually lay out the argument quite that way, I have heard some other teachers imply very similar things by declaring that the unmarried need to get married in order to solve the problem of lust if they are being faced with that temptation. I'll admit that as a teenager, I believed very similar things, and they turned out to be very problematic things. And I've known many other Christians who had to learn the hard way that that common interpretation of 1 Corinthians 7 and 9 is flawed. So I put together this sermon because I think it's important to be able to hear teaching on what 1 Corinthians 7 actually means. And that way, when we are sharing this with other teachers or to new generations of people growing up in the church, we'll be able to explain it without giving people a false idea of how dating and marriage is supposed to work. So for a few moments, this is what we're going to be talking about tonight. I'd like to examine whether the Bible teaches that marriage is the cure for lust. It's kind of spoilers for the end, it does not. And I'd like to address this in four questions. So first, what can we do to rule out challenging or maybe even incorrect interpretations of 1 Corinthians 7? Second, to ask, is marriage given or prescribed as a cure for lust in the Bible? Third, I'd like to talk about whom Paul was addressing and what his purpose was in this passage. And then finally, what guidelines for holy living can be found outside of the passage of 1 Corinthians 7. In other words, are there any other passages that actually weigh in on this subject and help us out? I think there are a few. So we're going to start with this first question of what can we do to rule out incorrect interpretations. And essentially what we're going to be doing here is busting what I call the myth of deferred responsibility, the idea that I'm having a problem, but I'm going to push that responsibility onto somebody else. So that's the first thing I want to consider. Remember that this poor or incorrect interpretation that I'm addressing is the belief that Paul taught young unmarried men to be married as a cure for lust if they could not control themselves. So that's the issue that we are addressing. Paul taught that unmarried men need to get married as a solution for lust. There are several problematic aspects of this belief that go against other areas of Scripture. I'm going to talk about three in particular that stand out to me. First, I'm going to summarize these three, and then we'll talk about each of them in a little more detail. So here's the summary. First, that belief implies that unmarried men are just victims of lust with no recourse against it except to be married. The Bible doesn't teach that. Whenever we sin, we actively participate in those sins. Secondly, the belief implies that it is therefore not a man's fault if he lusts following his initial search for a wife because he doesn't have access to the cure or to the solution, which is marriage. And a final problem is that the view implies that given that moral responsibility for sin has to fall somewhere, it must be the fault of women for causing men to lust and then denying them the right to marriage. Hopefully, as I read that and laid out some of those lines of logic, you were feeling uncomfortable about it. But unfortunately, there are Christians who see no problems with that line of reasoning. So we're going to examine each of these claims in turn to determine whether they can plausibly fit with a good interpretation of the passage. We're going to start with this first problematic belief that unmarried men are just victims of lust, and furthermore, that they have no recourse against it except to be married. In 1 Corinthians 7 and 8, Paul told his audience that it is good for them, the people he's speaking to, if they abide even as I, in other words, that they remain single. I don't actually think that Paul was addressing all unmarried people in this passage, but let's say for the sake of argument that he was. Paul seemed to believe that there would be people like himself who could remain unmarried and further dedicate themselves to God's service, meaning that not everyone has to get married to deal with that problem. So the only conclusion we can draw from Paul's belief here is that it is, in fact, not only plausible, but probable that people can remain single without succumbing to that particular sin. In other words, if we're following Paul's logic here, it's really just an excuse to say that all unmarried people are just kind of victims of lust, that it just happens to them without their participation, and that they're automatically going to succumb to that sin if they don't get married. You don't automatically succumb to any sin. And there's an even more clear passage responding to this issue in Paul's later writing to the Corinthians. In the same letter, chapter 10 and verse 13, Paul says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." And I think there's something comforting about part of this verse telling us that we're not alone in whatever temptations might be a struggle for us. But on the other hand, I also think there's something very sobering about the fact that our struggles may not necessarily be as unique as we sometimes want to think about. It's easy for us, particularly as men, to play the victim card if we can cast ourselves as being persecuted by a unique sin, to say that we're really special in the way that we're affected by something. But we're not tragic heroes languishing with special sins that are a particular burden for us to bear. And if we treat ourselves like we are, then we start treating the sin like it's something that just happens to us, instead of remembering that it's our choice to participate in the sin that brings about the wrongdoing. So our conclusion has to be that the Bible communicates that there is a way to abstain from sexual temptation besides being married, and we're going to explore some of those possibilities as we get further along, but that it's not enough for someone wrestling with that particular sin to say, there's nothing I can do except get married. And of course, the later conclusion of that logic, other people are causing me to sin because they won't date or marry me. It's a false pretense. So that's exactly what we're going to talk about next, the idea that it's not necessarily a man's fault if he lusts following his essential search for a wife, because the only way that he has to escape that lust is to get married, and if people won't marry or date him, well, that's their fault for causing him to sin. This is also a problematic perspective. Rather than advocating for this deferment of responsibility, for this pushing of accountability onto someone else, Jesus taught something different, that people should be proactive and take personal action to abstain from sin. He told us in Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 through 29, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell." What this is telling us is that each person has their own ability to choose righteousness or sin. Now, it may be more or less difficult for certain people or in certain circumstances, but ultimately we have the right to choose. Criswell explained this regarding the passage. He said, "Anything that ensnares the Christian must be radically removed regardless of its preciousness. Jesus is not advocating for ritualism or self-mutilation. One can pluck out his eye and cut off his hands and still be lost in the final judgment. No amount of physical mutilation will cleanse the heart. But by using figurative language and hyperbole, Jesus shocks his hearers as to the seriousness of sin." In other words, the Lord's teaching on handling lust was that the tempted person needs to start by making changes in their life to address the problem. The unmarried have a personal responsibility to discipline themselves. And they do have moral culpability if they decide not to discipline themselves. This takes us to the final line of logic that's sometimes associated with this challenging view. Given that someone has to be morally responsible for sin, that has to fall somewhere, usually these folks say it must be the fault of women for causing men to lust and then denying them the right to be married. I think based on what we just talked about, we already have some idea of how to answer this claim, given that we know each person has their own responsibilities regarding lust. God has held each person accountable for their actions from the beginning of time, and that continues to now with this particular form of sin. Consider the law in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 16, where the Bible says, fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers, but a person shall be put to death for his own sin, according to the law there. Now, this principle also exists in the New Testament, perhaps most famously in Philippians 2 and verse 12, which says to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. What does that mean? It's your responsibility to make sure that you are conforming to what God demands of you. So the thrust of this passage was to encourage the Philippians to do good by emphasizing their personal responsibility in obeying God. The point of reading all of these verses is to demonstrate that 1 Corinthians 7 cannot be telling young, unmarried men that lust is the fault of women or that marriage is the ultimate cure to the sin of lust. People can potentially be influenced by outside sources. I don't want to minimize that. So other people in someone's life can make it harder on them if they are being careless about the ways that they interact with them or treat them and so forth. But our thoughts and the way that we respond to them are ultimately our own. So we should not be teaching things that enable young men to pressure young sisters to say yes to their romantic advancements out of a faux sense of obligation that they need to indulge them for the sake of spirituality. That's just not true. Women do not cause men to sin by being romantically disinterested in them. And men who complain about lack of attention from women and then blame those women for their own personal temptations are lacking in self-control and they're lacking in knowledge of the scriptures. And again, I don't mean to be overly harsh. It's okay if someone has their feelings hurt, experiences disappointment by rejection. I've been in that boat myself. But it's not okay to hold grudges against people, to become perpetually bitter, to become vengeful, to place the blame for your own sins on somebody else if you happen to be on the wrong path. So given this list of passages, we can safely eliminate the notion that Paul was telling unmarried people that lust is inevitable without marriage. There are some things that happen or some other things that we can read throughout the Bible that sort of reinforce this point. So even if we accept that lust is the primary responsibility of the individual, as I think we should, we might ask if marriage can work as a cure for temptation, and if so, to what degree, and is it a surefire remedy? The Apostle Paul does seem to indicate that marriage is one method to alleviate certain types of temptation. However, the dangerous view here is to say that we want unmarried people to believe that wedding someone is going to automatically solve this problem and take it away. We know that marriage is not an ultimate fix for this temptation because the Bible addresses problems that take place after marriage in regard to sexual immorality. For example, the wise king advised his son in Proverbs 6 and verse 32, whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. Very similarly, in the New Testament, Hebrews 13 and verse 4 says, marriage is honorable among all and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. What is this sin of adultery? It's intimacy between a married person and other individuals besides their spouse. The very existence of this sin creates a problem for those who interpret 1 Corinthians 7 to mean that marriage is the cure or escape for experiencing lust, because adultery is a sin of intimacy that happens after you're married. So the problem can take place after the wedding vows have already been spoken. Marriage does not just automatically cure a problem of habits in our mind. I've spent time talking with someone who worked for a company that provides accountability software for people who are trying to handle their difficulty with consuming inappropriate media. And this person told me that many of their customers who purchase accountability software are married people who say in surveys and interviews that they expected their temptations to go away after they became married, and then they were surprised when those temptations remained, even after they said their vows. So what I'm saying is, bad habits and bad thought patterns can continue after someone is married. And if we teach young people that this works some other way, we're setting them up for failure in their dating lives and in their marriages. This fact brings up some additional problems with interpreting 1 Corinthians 7, at least if we interpret it to say marriage is a cure for lust. So in light of those passages we've read beyond 1 Corinthians 7, 9, the interpretation that marriage is a cure seems a little bit less like an innocent attempt to understand the Bible and perhaps a little bit more like an excuse that some people have to relentlessly pursue women without taking no for an answer. In short, it is an interpretation that treats women as a means to the end of satisfying someone's lust rather than as people who are valuable in and of themselves. Our sisters are absolutely more valuable than simply being mechanisms to help men deal with their desires. And the Bible talks about this in great detail. Women afford partnership and exemplify strong character. We learn about in Proverbs 31:10 and Genesis 2:18. They express care and leadership, Titus 2:3-5 and Proverbs 31:20. They work hard and convey strength, Proverbs 31:17. They can convey their leadership with even shrewd business skills, Proverbs 31:18. They teach others, they apply wisdom, Acts 18:26, Proverbs 31:26, and this list can go on and on and on. So we have to teach younger men as they grow up that women are also made in the image of God, and their value lies far beyond simply being a candidate as a potential spouse. There's nothing wrong with being interested in someone as a potential spouse, but if that's the only value that you see in them, that's going to create big problems and already indicates that we're thinking in the wrong direction. Another related problem for this incorrect interpretation of 1 Corinthians 7 in light of other scriptures is that it assumes the road to salvation is outside of the individual's hands. In other words, if someone has to get married in order to avoid lust and sin, then they can only be saved if another person decides to marry them. So this flies in the face of biblical teachings about free moral agency, which assert that every person is responsible for their own obedience to God. Remember the passages we've already read in Philippians 2:12. There are other places like Ezekiel 18:20 that mention very similar things. So the idea here is that our salvation can't be dependent on whether or not somebody else agrees to be in a partnership with us. A passage that I think is really helpful here is Galatians 5, verses 13 through 17, which I'm going to go ahead and read. Galatians 5, 13 through 17. The Bible says, "For you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish." In this passage, Paul describes every person as having a moral battle. He said that each person would have the power to serve God, to focus on spiritual things, or to follow their own fleshly desires. We can all choose our own walk, whether we wish to walk in the Spirit or whether we wish to walk in the flesh. And that choice, while we may allow the influence of others, cannot be dependent on anyone but ourselves. So we can suffice it to say that our relationship with God does not necessarily depend on someone else agreeing to be our spouse. Others can help us in our spiritual walk, which is one of the potential blessings of marriage, but they are not responsible for whether we walk in the Spirit or walk in the flesh. So because getting married is not fully in one person's control, it takes two, that means that it would be unfair and unjust to expect that someone's salvation would depend on their being married. All right, y'all have been very patient. We're through the longest part. We've talked a lot about what this passage does not mean. The brief summary of this is that the passage does not mean that marriage is an ultimate cure for lust. It does not mean that marriage is a condition of salvation. It does not mean that marriage is even a necessity for modern life. But if the passage does not mean those things, what does it mean? So remember that Paul's letter starts by being addressed to the entire congregation at Corinth, and that everyone there constituted the audience, unless he specifies otherwise. And in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 8, Paul actually specifies that he was giving instructions to particular members of the congregation, rather than giving a broad message. He initiated this kind of aside by saying, "But I say to the unmarried and to the widows." Now, widows are a category of unmarried people, which has left this English translation a little bit confusing at times. So I think that Paul would have probably not felt the need to specify widows if unmarried applied to all unmarried people here. So who is he talking to? Bailey's explanation and the Contending for the Faith commentary, I think, helps to untangle the problem. He wrote, "In this verse, some apply the word unmarried to every unmarried person, men and women, but this conclusion is not valid, for had Paul meant that all people, he would have had no reason to say, and widows, for they would have already been included. Most likely, Paul is referring only to widowers, because in the same verse he restricts himself to speaking to widows, women who have been married but their husbands have died. So the most logical conclusion is that Paul has only widowers and widows in mind. The other groups will be dealt with later in the chapter." Bailey also went on to say that the term "better" in that verse, when it says it is better to marry, does not indicate a more righteous or holy position, but something that might be advantageous depending on someone's individual circumstances. The conclusion here is that Paul was likely speaking directly to people who had already been married, who were therefore accustomed to the benefits of married life, and was telling that group of people that they were welcome to marry again if they did not feel that they could remain single. His message does not mean that they were required to marry again, but they had the option to do that if they decided to. Furthermore, the Greek word that we translate to "burn" in this phrase, "it's better to marry than to burn," denotes a continued dissatisfaction of some sort. So we get more clues to the meaning by asking what would be dissatisfactory. The obvious answer here seems to be the relationship between an unmarried person and their affectionate other. So it seems to me that Paul's message is likely directed to people who have once been married, but their spouse has died. Now they've met someone else. They have a new affectionate other, and they have a mutual longing for one another. People who are in love, but they were afraid to or morally opposed to getting remarried for whatever reason. Sometimes people think, "Kyle, that's a very narrow interpretation of that passage. Would that even apply today?" It does. We still have people who get into the same situation today. For example, after my grandmother passed, my grandfather decided that he didn't want to be in another romantic relationship after that because he was taught that it was appropriate to be a one-woman man, which he interpreted to mean that he would only ever be married to one person in his life. That's basically the same situation that Paul was addressing here by telling widows and widowers that they could choose to remain unmarried, but they were not required to do so. So they could do what my grandpa did and decide that they wanted to stay single. But if they felt like they needed companionship, Paul was telling them it's not a sin to get remarried. So for some people who had lost their spouses, they may have even risked entering back into sin by deciding not to marry because they found someone else, an affectionate other, a person they were in love with, and they were trying not to marry them, even though that was difficult because they felt that they weren't supposed to. If someone is accustomed to the benefits of marriage, they might desire another partner after their original spouse passes. So Paul was saying, if you're concerned about getting remarried, don't be. Go ahead. Do what you need to do. So in some of this section, it's doubtful that the passage regards just any unmarried person. If we conclude that the Bible, therefore, does not teach that first marriage is the ultimate cure for lust, and then we determine that Paul was not generically speaking to all unmarried people, then that leaves us without very much on dealing with the general temptation of lust. So does the Bible have any advice for young unmarried people? There could be a whole sermon dedicated to just this topic, so I am only going to scratch the surface of this. But the basic answer is yes. There are a host of other passages besides 1 Corinthians 7 that work a lot better to help us out with dealing with this problem. In the letter to Titus, Paul gave advice to his younger friend about how to lead the congregations in which he was ministering. And the apostle started by giving Titus advice for how to work with older men, then advice for how to work with older women, and then to younger women, and finally to young men. And his message for how to guide the younger men is found in Titus 2, verses 6 through 8. There he says, "Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded, in all things showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you." In another Contending for the Faith commentary, Fussell expanded on Paul's message to Titus, and he said, "Titus is to urge young men to exercise self-discipline, self-control, and self-mastery. Discipline is the ability to regulate conduct by principle and judgment, rather than by impulse or desire or high pressure or the customs or traditions of men. If young men are well disciplined in mind, body, and character, they will be strong, successful Christians in every respect." So this is a lot easier said than done, no question about that. But the cure for temptation that's given in the Bible is discipline. Again, that's really hard. It sounds simple. It can be really hard. But that's the actual solution that's given. This is a necessary part of Christianity, no matter what temptation someone is dealing with, though, given that we're called to be disciples, and to be a disciple means to participate in a teacher's discipline. So we are called to form certain habits in our thoughts and in our behaviors as a part of our service to Christ. And regarding the bearing of this principle on 1 Corinthians 7, if someone is trying to get married just so that they can control their temptations toward lust, then perhaps they need to consider that they might need to develop greater self-discipline before they attempt to entangle someone else in those problems, rather than trying to fix it after the fact. Again, I don't mean to be overly harsh, because I realize that dating can be awkward, that the world of mass media throws all kinds of temptations at people, and especially at young Christian men. So my purpose in discussing 1 Corinthians 7 was not to deny sympathy to folks who deal with this temptation. It's just been a way to teach what I believe is a more accurate understanding of a passage that I've heard mistaught over and over. And that's important to me so that people don't fall into the trap of dating for desire instead of dating for godly partnership. It can be incredibly damaging if someone has difficulties with a particular temptation. They have not put any plan in place to try and deal with that, and then they draw someone else into that. It can be very hurtful. So quickly, I want to mention four things, that we can do as a part of developing self-discipline, and perhaps that we can use in the case that we falter in our discipline from time to time. Even people who are trying to do the right thing make mistakes from time to time along the way. So what do you do when things seem particularly hard? One thing you can do is to seek advice from a Christian friend or a leader who you trust. For instance, David and Jonathan acted as confidants for each other during the days of King Saul. There's a woman named Chloe who sought Paul's advice about congregational problems in 1 Corinthians 1 and 11. There are many proverbs dedicated to discussing the virtues of seeking sound advice. So talking to a spiritual advisor is something we can do if we find ourselves being overwhelmed with temptation that's taking us off track from our usual discipline. I think a comforting verse here would be 1 Corinthians 10:13, which says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common." So sometimes it might feel challenging or embarrassing to go and talk to someone about the things that we're struggling with. But I think it's helpful to remember that whatever it is, other people have had difficulty with it too. So talk to someone with whom you feel comfortable and try and let them help you. The second thing we can do is to make a plan. Try to create a strategy for how you're going to respond in tempting circumstances. If you know that hanging around certain people or engaging in particular media or other circumstances could be a trigger for a problem, try to avoid situations that might create a stumbling block. In our modern age, I think this includes choosing our friends wisely as well, both on and off social media. We need to be careful not to subject ourselves to images or circumstances that would be particularly tempting for us, whether that's a situation that happens in person or a situation that we're in online. We need friends who concentrate on godly things and portray godly things in the way that they present themselves, not things that are going to tempt us to indulge ourselves and give up our self-discipline, 1 Corinthians 15:33. A third thing we can do is we can spend time praying about it. We can take time to share our concerns with God because he tells us that he wants to hear from us. 1 Peter 5:6-7 says, "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you." You know what that means to me is that God doesn't want you to fail. He knows that things are difficult sometimes, and he wants you to spend time talking to him about your troubles. And you know what? If we focus our time talking to God, then we're spending that time in a way that's productive and useful, and that distances us from other things that might be more hurtful for our minds to be focused on. So prayer is a very productive and helpful way to fill our time. And the last thing might sound cheesy, but I think it's important. The last thing I wanted to recommend is that if you're dealing with a particular temptation, whether that's lust or whatever else, believe in yourself. God tells us we can overcome anything with the help of Christ. Things that feel overwhelming on our own might feel a little less burdensome with the right help. We have the famous passage that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And for a long time, I was focused on that I can do all things part. And I thought, Christ is with me because I'm a Christian and I'm going to church as much as I can. But I was really focused on what I was doing. And that through Christ part, I think, is really important to understand. As humans, we have weaknesses. But it's by doing the things that we learn in the Bible, talking with spiritual advisors, putting ourselves in good situations, praying, all of those things that Jesus is trying to teach us about, how to reform our habits, the things that come from Jesus are the things that help us in overcoming those temptations and becoming better Christians. So we have a few things that we can do, and this is just kind of the starter pack, I guess, in the interventions we can take in trying to be stronger in our Christian walk. And I appreciate y'all's patience tonight. These are the thoughts that I had prepared. And at this point in the service, we like to say that if there's anyone who has a need, we'd be happy to pray for you if you want to come up and let it be known, or if you want to talk after services. If there's anything that you think the congregational leaders here can do for you to help you out in your Christian walk, let us know during or after we sing this song of invitation.